I'm a transgender woman, and so, of course, people listening to this will hear a masculine voice, but as I can assure your listeners, I'm very feminine appearing. And I transitioned genders in 2009. And at the time, I was a lawyer in Iowa, having my own law firm. I had been married to my high school sweetheart for a very long time. But my marriage didn't survive my gender transition. And when I transitioned, there was a point where I made the decision that rather than continue to be a traditional trial lawyer, which is something I had been doing, that I was going to go back to what my roots were. And I am a student of Dr. King and Robert Kennedy. I was alive when both of them were alive, and actually I remember vividly the days that they were murdered. But both of them taught, when they were alive, that we have an obligation to try and make this world a better place. It's not voluntary, that it's something that we are obligated to do as good citizens. So when my world as a man came crashing down and I set out to create a life as a woman, I wanted that life to be very authentic, and included within that authenticity was me being someone who would follow the words of Dr. King and Robert Kennedy and try and make a difference in the world. So I go out. In addition to running, I run a small nonprofit in Minneapolis that helps low-income people connect with lawyers. But in addition to that, I go forward in the world and do a great deal of speaking about what it means to be transgender, but also really what it means to be different in our society and how it is that we can welcome anyone who is different. And that's really what I'm doing.
And you came here to speak today about
gray area thinking.
Yes, what is gray area thinking?
Well, gray area thinking is a tool set aimed at helping people to better understand how to interact with people who are different. I've got air quotations there, from us, more air quotations. As a reality, we are hardwired across the board to want to be with people who look like us, who sound like us, who have the same values. And that tribal kind of mentality, while there are many good things about it because it creates communities for people, it also excludes people. And it makes it very difficult for somebody who's not part of the tribe to feel included, to be able to contribute to society, and to be in a position where they can feel that they're valued by the community. Gray area thinking is a way of integrating people who are different, a tool set. It has three components, one which is about awareness of human vulnerability or suffering. The second component is risk-taking to reduce or alleviate that suffering or vulnerability, and the third component is acting with compassion and kindness.
I'm a rancher in South Dakota, and I haven't met a lot of transgender people. How do I interact with them? How do I develop gray area thinking when I, you know, my life has been, you know, on a ranch my entire life?
So first of all, gray area thinking is much broader than just about transgender people. It's about people who are of color, people who are foreign-born, folks who have different religions. So it's much broader than that. But if, for your rancher, my answer is, first of all, I think as humans we have the capacity to be curious about other people. And I also believe that everyone really wants to do the right thing. Then part of the right thing is welcoming other people. But we're afraid. We don't know how to welcome people. We're afraid that we're going to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing, or act in some way. And so then what we just do is we don't interact. So my words to the rancher would be, read up, get some training on unconscious bias and implicit bias, learn more about the world, and understand that the next farmhand that the rancher may hire might be somebody of color, or it might be somebody who's transgender, because I'm going to assume that some of your ranchers and farming community is already understanding that there's a labor shortage going on in this country, and somebody is going to have to fill it. And in order for those people to fill it, people are going to have to expand their consciousness about what's acceptable. Who am I willing to work with? Right now, in our country, the baby boomers are starting to retire, which means eventually the baby boomers are going to need home health care aides. There is a shortage of home health care aides in the country right now. That shortage is going to get worse. Who's going to fill those shortages? It's going to be people of color. It's going to be lesbian or gay people. It's going to be foreign-born people. And you're right. Attitudes will change when you need to have somebody come and help you with your household or help you with your daily hygiene needs, those types of things, for sure.
What are some of these signs up here?
So we're sitting in a room right now at the public library in Rapid City, and on the walls are a number of different labels or signs, such as country of origin, vocation, socioeconomic class, age, race, sexual orientation. These are all part of what I call the identity game. If we have a large room with people, what I do is I lay the foundation by saying that we all have a variety of identities and a variety of labels. We as humans only can operate by putting people in boxes and categories. We have to do that because that's the way we sort our world. For example, the very first time when somebody is pregnant, you know, what is the question that a pregnant woman gets when she gives birth? I guess she's no longer pregnant at that point. But what's the very first question that a new mom gets? The question always is, was it a boy or a girl? Why is that? Why do we ask that rather than what color hair did they have? How many pounds were they? How long were they? And the reason we ask that is because we instantly, as humans, we have to get things into categories in order for us to interact with them. And this, again, goes back to how we are tribal and we need to be able to interact with, we're comfortable with interacting with our kind. So these labels that we have in the room are about how we label ourselves and how we label other people's. And the way the identity game works is I ask a series of prompts, such as the identity that was most important to my parents for me as I was growing up was X. And so many people that is will, and then I ask people to stand up and walk to the sign that is responsive to that question. So I ask that question, and many people will go over to the education sign, or they'll go over to the religious affiliation sign. Other prompts that I ask are the identity that gives me the most amount of privilege, depending on the number of people and where they're coming from in the room. Many times we have people who will show up and stand by the sign of vocation or socioeconomic class, or sometimes they'll stand by race. Another prompt I ask is the identity that I'm most discriminated against having, okay? You know, and many times if we have people of color in the room, they'll stand next to the race sign. If we have white, middle-aged women or older women, they'll stand over by the gender sign. Sometimes I have people who stand by age. Rarely are people willing to stand by sexual orientation, but I know that I have those folks in our audience, but some of that is about self-disclosure, and that makes people uncomfortable.
I know, as you were alluding to, a lot of these categories are shortcuts for us to identify certain people. Are these categories bad?
No, not at all. I don't think that I'm self-described as a humanist, okay? And I think part of that is just recognizing that we in the human condition operate a certain way, okay? That's great. I understand that. But there's some defaults that we go to that create problems, as I've alluded to. If you're not part of the tribe, if you're not one of us, then you're on the outside. And I think that everyone listening can remember a time or two or maybe several where they've been not one of the group. And how does that feel? Now imagine that society is organized that way and that it's not just simply about social activities, but it's about jobs or it's access to healthcare, the judicial system, and you're being excluded because of where you've come from. These labels help us to understand what we do as humans. I don't think they're bad. I just think that we need to understand them, and then we need to work around them.
We need to be more aware of them.
More aware of them, and that gets us to my gray area thinking tool set, which is awareness, risk-taking, to alleviate the vulnerability or suffering of other people, and always acting with compassion and kindness. Again, I think that we as humans want to do the right thing. I think most people really want that, but they're just afraid to ask how to do the right thing, or they haven't been educated on it, or they don't have access to the kind of training that I provide in communities.
On your letterhead right there, just below the logo and your name, it says writer, lawyer, and human. What does that mean?
Well, remember, I mean, we are a society of labeling, okay? And I am a writer. I am somebody who I've written a memoir, Getting to Ellen, a memoir about love, honesty, and gender change. I also write a monthly column in the Twin Cities about what my experience is to interact in the world as a transgender person who is very feminine appearing, as I've said, but has this male voice, so you can imagine some of the situations that I encounter. I am also a lawyer by training, so before I transitioned, I was a trial lawyer in Iowa. I've tried over 100 lawsuits. I was a very good lawyer, and I also learned about public speaking and my ability to share about various things and help people to understand topics that might be complex. In the end, I'm also a human. I really am, and I show up when I speak at my meetings with audiences. I think the one thing above all else that they take away is that I'm authentic. You know, I'm very self-deprecating. I make a lot of fun of myself. People are enamored by that, but most of all, I'm honest about some of the struggles that we have. And I talk about the commonalities that we have. I have this phrase called the four commonalities. So even though I don't know you, Lee, who's interviewing me, and the other people in this room, I know four things about you. And because we all have this in common. So the very first thing we have in common is that everyone in this room wants our children or our nieces or nephews or grandchildren to succeed. The second thing is we very much want to be free of physical or emotional violence. The third thing is we all want some element of peace. I mean, we're all old enough to know that we're never going to get 100% complete peace. That may only come in the last 5 minutes of our lives as we're taking our last breath. But everyone wants 20 minutes out on the patio watching the sun go down, enjoying their favorite beverage, without somebody saying, honey, where is the? Or the telephone ringing with that adult child having yet another crisis that they want you to respond to. And the fourth thing, the last thing that we all have in common is that we want to love and be loved. It's that simple. And if we can remember that, if we can understand that as a community, we have the foundation right there with those four things to go forward, to be inclusive, to be welcoming of all people. Because if you remember those four things, you can have a conversation with anybody. Hey, you got kids? Let me tell you about mine. Okay? You know, guess what? Now you've just started a conversation with a stranger. And so my goal, all I'm doing is I'm going across the country reminding people about many things that we already know and just trying to get them focused on those things as a way of spurring thoughts for your rancher who hasn't been challenged to think that way. And again, we're back to, I think people really are good-natured And I think it just takes somebody saying, have you thought about this? And as I go across the country, I find that people are so very receptive to my training and my words, and they come away telling me, thank you. Thank you for helping me think differently, thinking in the gray rather than in black and white.
South Dakota recently joined several other states against President Obama's White House mandate on, I think it's commonly referred to as the bathroom bill.
Yes.
I guess, what are your thoughts on, I think I can assume some of your thoughts anyways, on this lawsuit, and how does somebody who's unsure of their identity from South Dakota make their decision with that also going on, knowing that in the state these things are going on? How does that has to be a...
Well, there are two sides of this equation. The very first side is the people who are uncomfortable with the idea that a transgender person be able to use a restroom that accords with what their gender identity is. So even though I was born male, my gender identity is female, and yes, I want to use the female restroom. So for the folks who are uncomfortable with that kind of concept, the question I have is, how many transgender people do you know? How many of you ever met? How many of you ever had a conversation? How many of you ever sat down to understand those four commonalities that I just talked about? The transgender people have the same commonalities with you about those things. You know, I believe in the power of familiarity, that once you get to know people, your governor, by the way, vetoed a bill, but only after he met with three transgender people and he got to understand and know them as humans and be able to sit and understand, well, these are people too, just like me or just like the younger people that he knew in his life. And so that's that side of the equation. For people who are transgender or gender questioning or gender variant, what I say to you is this. I understand your fear. It's a place of great fear because you're worried about losing people. That's what happens with transgender people who come out, who transition, because other people believe it's a choice. And I can assure you it is not a choice. The only choice for a transgender person is whether they transition to be who they really are or whether they die. Transgender people have the highest incidence of suicide attempts and actual suicides of anybody else in the LGBTQ, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer alphabet. And their suicide rate is 40 times the national average for people who are straight or not transgender or gay or lesbian. And so there's great fear. There's great loss for people who transition. And my words to you, if you're listening, are these. Believe in yourself. Understand that you have great, great resiliency, that you have the strength to make it through. And all I can tell you is show up as who you are. Believe that this authenticity thing is so powerful that you need to be true to yourself. And that eventually all of society will fall into place. We will have bumpiness before we get there, no doubt. But eventually, the handwriting is on the wall, that eventually everybody will be able to live authentically, and other people will be able to understand it, including your rancher out in the country.
Mine's really more, mine's more on the scientific part of it. You said it's not a choice.
Sure.
Could you... I've not ever known anyone that was transgender.
Sure.
Can you help me understand by not a choice what that means and how you get to be who you are and what percentage of our population deals with these challenges every day?
Okay. No, don't worry about it. I'm going to go a little bit backwards on that, okay? First of all, no one knows the number of people who are gender variant in the country or in the world. And the reason for that is that transgender people are very afraid. For the reasons that I just enunciated, that there are two types of transgender people: gender correctors, that is, people who for decades live according to their birth gender, And then realize that they're not living the life that they need to lead, and so then they correct. And that's me. I lived as a man I presented as a man for 50 years, and then I could no longer do it, and I transitioned to female. But there is also another group of transgender people in the country, which are trans kids. These are the 4, the 5, the 6 years old. You know, somebody born as a boy, identified as a boy at birth, who says, "Mommy, mommy, I'm not a boy. I'm really a girl." You know, and my name is Ashley and not David. And I want to wear girl clothes and play with girl toys. And I want to go to school and be known as a girl. That group of people is emerging and really exploding in a great degree. And a lot of that is because of the internet. The parents 20 years ago, when their child was saying that, the only recourse they had was, "This is weird, and no, you're a boy, and if you don't accept that, you're not getting dinner tonight," you know. And in many cases, it was far worse, the reaction from the parents. But now the parents have the internet, and they understand that there are many, many parents, hundreds of thousands of parents, who have children who are identifying contrary to what their birth gender was. And those parents have support groups, they have therapists, they have doctors, and they have communities that they can go to and understand this is natural. And so the number is unknown, okay? But it's a lot more people than anyone knows, because there are a lot of people that are hidden and are afraid and are in the closet. The second thing, to answer your question about how can it be, the simple answer is that for some people, the brain does not match the body. I don't know why. I don't know if it's biological at the time in utero, something happens. I don't know if it's genetic, chromosomal. I have no idea. But what I know is, for my case and for, you know, millions of other people, that the brain, my brain was female, my body was male, and because the brain did not match the body, I had great, the technical phrase is dysphoria, but I had just great, horrible emotional ability to cope with life. And I hit it well because transgender people are very good at compartmentalizing. But eventually, for many transgender people, we have a moment of truth. For me, my moment of truth was realizing that despite having built a life presenting as a man that was the life that most people in the world could possibly want, that for me, it was not working. And that unless I did something to make my brain and my body match and my life match my brain, that I would lay on my deathbed and I would look back and I would regret that I had not been braver about living my life authentically. So when I go and speak and I get the question about choice, because people are like, "Well, you're choosing to do this. You know, for 50 years you lived as a man. Why on year 51 is it? Why on one day that you wear a man's suit and then that's the last time you can do it and you can't wear a man's suit ever again? It has to be a woman's dress. Why is that?" And the answer is that we all get to a point where we say, enough. So the analogies that I have are for people who are divorced. When you stood at the altar or the justice of peace and you gave your vows that you would love and cherish somebody for the rest of your life, you absolutely intended that that's the way it was going to be. And no one ever wakes up one day and says, "You know what? I'm going to get divorced today. You know, I was in love yesterday. I'm going to get divorced today." It is a process of incrementally understanding that the relationship that you got into with a certain person isn't working. and it's not right for you. Even though you believed it was, even though society says that's the way it should be for you. And eventually people say, I can't do this anymore, and I need to go and live my life in a different way. People who are gay or lesbian, I mean, in theory, a man is supposed to only, you know, love a woman. But there's some wiring, something, that causes many men to be attracted sexually and emotionally to other men, and women to be attracted to other women. People grow up being told, if you're male, that you should have an attraction to a female. And many try it that way, but it doesn't work. And it's not a choice when they say, I can't do this anymore. I'm only attracted to men, and I'm only going to be with men. That's not a choice. I think that's called living authentically. You know, all of us as humans are trying to find our way through the world. We do not have an owner's manual. Not at all. No one lays it out for us. And because we all have our thing, and because many of us are trying to find our way, for people who aren't gay or lesbian or transgender, you know what society calls it? They call it finding yourself. You've heard that phrase, right? For transgender people, it's called transitioning. I found myself. Myself is female, not male, and I am living as I really am. And lastly, let me just say this. I tried everything I could to stay a man. I married, as I said earlier, my high school sweetheart. We were together for 32 years. I loved her with all my heart. And in fact, for much of my life, I loved her far more than I loved anyone else, including myself. When my dysphoria, so this tension between brain and body, wasn't working, you know, when I could no longer keep it at bay, I went to therapy. Before it was done, I saw 8 or 9 different therapists, and I was in therapy for 17 years. I tried countless different kinds of therapists. I tried drugs. I tried alcohol. I tried all kinds of bargaining. I tried toys, buying myself toys, compensating, you know, with money, you know, or trips or something like that, all to hold the person inside of me at bay, believing that if I just did that, it would go away. If I just did that, I'd be able to still stay a boy and love my wife. I had a house in the best neighborhood in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I had 3 cars and a 4-car garage, 2 daughters in private school, my own law firm, a beautiful, loving wife, money in the bank, brokerage accounts. As I said, I had the life that anyone in the world could want. And for me, it just did not work. Because I wasn't a man. I'm really a woman. That's about the best I can explain to you how it's not a choice. And when I did transition, after I came out as Ellen Krug, what I consistently heard was, you are so much more patient, so much more relaxed. You are a nicer person than what you were as a man. I mean, I had people telling me you were really difficult, and because we're on radio, I won't use the words that they were saying as to describe me as a man. But time and again, I just heard, I really like you as Ellen. What value do we put on that? How do we put that in the constellation of what's important in the world? For me, that was validation. That was proof that I am living the life that I need to live. Even though I broke many hearts, and I lost much in the process. But in the process, I gained something. I gained me. Pretty important.
How hard is it to travel through South Dakota? You were talking earlier right. That, I mean, you're from Minneapolis. What's it like traveling through states like South Dakota?
Well, I'll tell you, I was in, so I'm in Rapid City tonight. Last night I was in Sioux Falls. I gave a gray area thinking talk in Sioux Falls to approximately 35, 40 people. I was welcomed with open arms. People were very, very welcoming, very open to me. And thus far, it's been very fine. My concern always is that I don't have legal rights in South Dakota. And after this, I'm going to Wyoming, where I also don't have legal rights. And so what that means is, in theory, at a hotel that I check into, if the owner of the hotel says, we don't want your type here, they can refuse me service. And in theory, I have no legal recourse against them. Same thing as if I go to a gas station and I want to fill up my car, and rather than use my bank card, I go and pay $20 to use the pump, and the person says, I don't want your money, I don't want your type. I'd have no recourse of any kind. That way, that's at the back of my mind. And I'm only here as a visitor. I can imagine, though, and can you imagine what it's like if you live here? And you know that your rights are lesser than the rights of other people. And that you are on slippery ground to a certain extent. I can't imagine what that would be like. Well, I take that back. I can imagine, and that's partly why I'm doing this work. I am trying to change the landscape. I am trying to make South Dakota and Wyoming and, frankly, every other state in the country that doesn't protect LGBTQ people, I'm trying to make them protective and welcoming. The reality is that I can drive from the Canadian border to the Mexican border without encountering a state where I have legal rights. That's a big problem, not only for me, but for a lot of people.
I heard a statistic recently that 42-44% of the people identified with that alphabet that you just said so smoothly, gay, lesbian, transgender,
bisexual, and queer, yeah. LGBTQ.
That the high schools were at that high of a level. Do you think that's true?
No.
Okay.
I mean,
you just hear all these stories.
Yeah. I've never heard that. I've never heard that kind of a statistic. But what I will say is that our young people today, our grade school kids even, our middle school kids, our high school kids, our college students for sure, are far more broad-minded, are far more welcoming and accepting, far more egalitarian and willing to live and let live anyone. Why is that? Schools, I think, in some parts of the country, are doing a really good job about educating people about the fact that you look different shouldn't mean that you're treated different. But apart from that, we have the internet. And people are seeing on the internet. They're seeing people being discriminated against. And then they're seeing people stand up for other people. I call it allyship. You know, it's an active action. It's great to be an ally, saying, yeah, I've got your back, okay? But allyship is active work, where you say, hey, you just said that joke about my friend, and you know what? That ain't cool. That's not cool. And don't do it again. You know? And we're a society of peers. Many of us, almost everyone, cares about what somebody else thinks. And if we start calling people out on their behaviors being unacceptable because you just marginalize somebody unfairly because of how they look or because Ellie Krug sounds like a man but looks like a woman, you know, if we call people out on it, things will change. And that's how it'll change in South Dakota. In South Dakota, it will be people coming forward saying, you know what, I have a neighbor who's transgender, and she is the nicest person, and telling their legislator that. It's legislators having family members who are coming out as gay or lesbian or transgender. You know, where the legislator previously had said, you know, I don't believe in this, and you know, I'm not going to vote for the rights of lesbian or gay or transgender or bisexual people. And then it turns out that their child or their nephew or niece or grandchild is gay or lesbian or transgender. You know what? Minds change. very quickly. Just think about John McCain. You know, I mean, we could go through a whole litany, a list of people who are very closed-minded, who suddenly became open-minded when a family member became authentic. And I think, and you know, I think that, you know, you've got younger people where categories are not self-defining, and they're more willing to explore. Thank you. They're more curious about the world. Thank you. And that may mean as it relates to identities. It may relate as to who they kiss. It may relate as to who they fall in love with. And it may also be transitional. You know, it could be for a certain, you know, a certain period of time. But that experience may inform them for the rest of their life to be open-minded to other people. And that's really what all this is about. I'm just asking people to have an open mind. You know, I'm a nice person. I think that most people, if you sat down and had a cup of coffee with me for a half hour, I think that you would like me. And I think that you'd have a better understanding of what it means to be different in our society. And maybe you would come away and saying, you know what? She's okay. Let's let her check into the hotel.